Welcome to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen. You hear a song from your past and the years melt. You're where you were back then, flooded by memories and emotions. Music therapy taps into this powerful experience. Individuals who haven't spoken in years can sing lyrics, and those who can't walk easily can move to rhythm. Music reaches those impaired by motor or speech disorders as a result of dementia, Alzheimer's, stroke, and traumatic brain injury. Our next guest was one of the first music therapists working in this field and remains a leading pioneer.
For nearly 40 years, Dr. Concetta Tomaino has explored the healing power of music. Her groundbreaking work, alongside renowned neurologist Dr. Oliver Sacks, led them to found the Institute for Music and Neurologic Function, where she continues to serve as executive director. The recipient of numerous awards for her research into music and neurological rehabilitation, Dr. Tomaino is on the faculty of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and Lehman College City University of New York.
Dr. Tomaino, this is such a fascinating topic, and we're so glad you could join us on Take Care.
Glad to be here.
What is it about music that stimulates primary areas of the brain? So how is a nonverbal person able to sing complete lyrics to familiar songs, or someone who can't walk? How are they able to, at least they can't walk without assistance, how are they able to take steps to the rhythm of music?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that scientists who are studying the actual perception of components of music in the brain are showing us that music isn't processed in just one part of the brain. So for us to appreciate and respond to, say, a song, which includes rhythm and melody and harmony and emotional context and memory associations, means that almost every part of our brain has to be turned on. And so when you think about it that way, there's a cumulative effect when somebody listens to a familiar piece of music that arouses multiple areas of the brain, not just one particular area of the brain. And so for that reason, it is a very powerful therapeutic tool for somebody who's starting to lose some aspects of brain function, because these other primitive parts of the brain, like the cerebellum, subcortical parts of the brain, are still functioning very actively and stimulated and aroused by that familiar music, allowing for then a hierarchical stimulation of higher cortical areas in the brain. So it's almost like when you're trying to think of something you forgot and you think of all these associations, if you forget somebody's name, you may think of letters of the alphabet to see if you get triggered with one of the letters. Music provides those kinds of cues because of that cumulative effect. For somebody who can't move, say somebody with Parkinson's who has problems initiating movement, we know that just the pulse of rhythm, the auditory stimulation of that rhythmic pulse, drives neurons in the basal ganglia, stimulates areas of the cerebellum, and that turn on of those neurons actually helps then the motor initiation that eventually becomes a physical action of walking and moving. With somebody who's lost their speech because of a stroke, specifically somebody who has something called Broca's aphasia or non-fluent aphasia, means that they had a stroke in a specific area in the left part of the brain. However, singing is dominant on the right side of the brain. And so we can use the melodic contour of music, of singing, to stimulate parallel pathways where they can draw upon these residual skills of singing to music where they can't use words independent of the melodic contour.
Would you just share some of those early stories about how you first discovered that music can reach people who were lost to dementia or other diseases?
Sure. Well, my very first experience is when I was doing my internship in music therapy. This was back in the 70s, where not much was known about Alzheimer's disease and dementia. And most people with Alzheimer's disease who were very severely impaired were left in specific units where they didn't get that much stimulation because people thought there was no response possible, that they were totally lost with this damaged brain that they had. When I played music for that particular group, several of them, half of them were catatonic, the other half were agitated and screaming and rocking in their chairs. It was a horrible situation. And I'm thinking, how can music possibly affect these individuals? And yet when I sang an old song that I thought they would possibly know, the people who were catatonic woke up and looked at me. People who were agitated stopped. And half of them started singing the words to the song. Now, these are people with end-stage dementia who were on a back unit. Families were told they had no response possible. And I'm thinking, here is noise in the environment that their brain is processing as familiar music. So if they could process sound, not only sound, but recognize it and recall words, that means that there's levels of ability still available to somebody with Alzheimer's disease. So that was in 1978, and there was really no research at that time in what allows this to happen. In 1980, when I came to Beth Abraham, where Dr. Sachs had discovered the impact of rhythm on people with post-encephalitic Parkinson's, the two of us literally hit it off immediately and said, we have to figure out what this is. We have to ask scientists how we can study this and how we can really understand what it is about music and the components of music that could drive function where there seems to be total dysfunction. And so over the years, there's been wonderful cases. I had a man who was nonverbal for 5 years after a stroke. He couldn't make a sound. He had just been newly admitted to our nursing home. I was singing an old Yiddish song that a lot of people in the group had known. And I heard these sort of throat sounds coming out of this gentleman, even though he was non-responsive. And the throat sort of weird sounds that were coming out were in time to the music and sort of up and down to the melody of the music. So I realized he was trying to sing the song. So every day for several weeks, I spent 5-6 minutes with him just singing the song over and over again. And by the second week, he was singing with me. And after he sang the words, he started talking. It was almost like the switch had to be turned on. And from that moment on, he spoke. Whatever was blocking that ability had been resolved in his singing. And I think it was because of the recruitment of these multiple levels of stimulation on very primary areas of brain level function that his initiation was given back to him, and he was able to talk. And so for the rest of his life, for several years after that, he was able to speak. You know, I can't say why he didn't speak for 5 years, but I do know that after singing the song for 2 weeks, he was speaking again.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Care, a conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen.
We're talking to Dr. Conchetta Tomeno. She's a pioneer in the field of music therapy and is both the executive director and co-founder of the Institute for Music and Neurologic Function. And what profound stories you have to share with your personal experience in helping people regain movement and sound. I'm curious how you decide which genre of music to use during one of these music therapy sessions.
Well, there's been some really good research on what music people tend to remember the best as they get older. And it tends to be music from their late teens to early 20s. And the reason for that is that those are the years in which somebody really develops their individual identity. It's when they spend the most time socializing with peers. It's usually when the first in their life start to happen, so songs related to dating and or getting married or, you know, starting to raise children. Maybe those ages have changed quite a bit in the past few generations, but it's pretty standard that those are the types of songs, the top 10 songs from those time periods tend to be music that somebody recognizes the best. Based on their cultural background, there's folk songs that may be typical that people of their culture will normally sing at parties or weddings, special events. If it's a religious institution, there may be hymns that would be important to the individual. So we really look at their cultural background, their age, ethnic background, and that's only if we don't know the person specifically. So there's sort of parameters, guidelines that we can use to gauge what may be important. Now, it doesn't always work because everybody has their own individual taste. So we may hit a general genre of music, but to find a really specific song that may have that personal connection to that individual is somewhat of an exploration.
And I want to talk about that personal connection, because obviously there's an emotional component here. It really calls up something inside you. So what about what I'm also curious about is, does music therapy tend to work better for those who have talent in music or who have a practice of creating music on a regular basis, or does it work just as well for the general population?
There's several ways that music works therapeutically. For a person with Alzheimer's disease, it's the emotional and historical connection, or the biographical connection to the song, that will help them connect to that music and possibly arouse some level of recognition and some emotional response and connections to themselves and to others. For a person with a movement disorder, may purely be the rhythm of that music that will allow for that movement. So it depends on what the challenge is for that individual and what component of music will be the best to treat or help facilitate recovery or maintenance of that function. So the music changes, the components of the music changes. The field, you know, when we talk about music therapy, the field of music therapy in the United States has been around since the 1950s. And so sometimes people talk about music therapy as the pure therapeutic aspect of music. And then there's the clinical practice of music therapy that is done by the professional trained music therapist. So
and let's talk about that practice of clinical therapy in music. How long are therapy sessions? How often? What period of time?
Well, like any therapy treatment, the music therapist will assess what the possible outcomes and objectives are for the individual based on their response to the music and what the clinical goal is. So, for example, somebody who's recently had a stroke, it may be appropriate to work with them several times a week in a very repetitive way, using a very specific component of music to help them regain their speech. For somebody who has an emotional issue, maybe a once or twice a week may be appropriate. And you keep assessing the person's response to see if the music is making a difference and if something needs to be changed. So, for example, I was working with a very famous musicologist once who had a major stroke, couldn't say a word, wasn't even able to sing lyrics of a song. And he was able to tap to the rhythm of the music, but couldn't make any other sounds. And so the first goal was to see whether he could intone to the melody of the songs first. So he was able to tap. First step was to see whether he can indeed get part of the melody back. As he started to improve that melody, then I started to insert some of the familiar words or the lyrics, familiar lyrics to those songs. And everything was a stepwise increment to see if he could achieve that goal. And as he achieved it, then the goal became more complex until after 2 months he was able to speak again on his own. So the ultimate goal is for him to speak, but the way to get to that goal was for him to sing and use pre-learned songs to facilitate that.
We only have a couple of minutes left, so I want to make sure to include questions about how widely available music therapy is in hospitals and nursing homes. And if it's not, can families arrange for private music therapists to come in for their loved ones?
Sure. Well, music therapists work in hospitals and nursing homes. I should say that there are maybe 7,000 music therapists trained in the United States for very diverse populations. So obviously there's not enough to meet every particular facility's capability of having music therapy. So what people should do is go to musictherapy.org, which is the American Music Therapy Association, or cbmt.org, which is the certification board for music therapists, and they can see if there is a trained music therapist in the area. Many music therapists consult to hospitals and facilities, as well as do in-home music therapy. My institute, the Institute for Music and Neurologic Function, which is imnf.org, also does consulting long distances through Skype, so people can also reach us and get advice about potential music therapy interventions.
And one final question, does insurance cover music therapy?
In some states it does. Medicaid usually does not. So it's up to the individual to check with their insurance. I keep hearing from my colleagues that they are getting reimbursed through private insurance, third-party insurance. So people should look, ask their insurance provider if they'll cover music therapy intervention. Many times it has to be physician prescribed. So if a neurologist is knowledgeable and the family asks to try music therapy, then the family goes to the insurance provider, says my doctor has referred my loved one for music therapy services. Will you cover it? Maybe they'll cover it partially.
Dr. Conchetta Tomeno is a leading music therapist, and she is the co-founder of the Institute for Music and Neurologic Function, along with renowned neurologist Dr. Oliver Sacks. She is currently their executive director. Thank you so much for this in-depth look at this fascinating topic.
My pleasure. Thank you.